Well, howdy ho there, listeners. With the COVID lockdown starting to ease, you gotta support your local record shops. If they are open, find out the best way you can help them out. But for those of you who aren't able to shop in a physical record store, head over to AudiophileUSA.com. AudiophileUSA.com is a family-owned and operated online record shop that only sells excellent and near-mint vinyl records. None of this VG, VG+, G crap there. AudiophileUSA.com only sells pristine vinyl at very reasonable prices. And there's a ton of it. AudiophileUSA.com has over 42,000 titles in stock, and they can ship directly to your front door, and they package them beautifully. So head over there now, AudiophileUSA.com, browse their massive selection, and get that final upgrade on the record of your dreams. That's AudiophileUSA.com, worldwide shipping on the cleanest records right to your doorstep. And with that, let's start this episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate here. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening. And let me just tell you, I appreciate all of you who are out there sharing this podcast on your social media and telling your friends about it. That's a huge help. Thank you very much. This week, I have an extremely special episode for you all, a conversation with one of my lifelong heroes, Mr. Mike Watt. Now, Mike, as you may know, is the founder and bass player of the Minutemen, one of the extremely innovative and pivotal bands in the early LA punk scene. However, his resume does not end there. Watt has also served playing bass with the likes of Firehose, Porno for Pyros, Fitted, The Second Men, and serving over a decade playing bass for Iggy and the Stooges. All this as well as founding the legendary Southern California record label New Alliance, which released records by Descendants, Husker Du, and more. Look, if the LA punk scene was the human body, Mike Watt is definitely the heart and testicles, because he has continued to follow his art and maintains the ethos and purity of the original spirit. Mike is very DIY. He drives, plays, and lives econo, and shares his stories freely and generously. Plus, he really knows how to tell a story, so it was my absolute honor to have a conversation with Mike Watt, one of my lifelong heroes, not just for music, but life itself. Now, if you are a patron of our show at patreon.com/vinylguide, man, are you in luck, because you have access to the full extended interview that we had with Mike Watt. It's up there now. You can listen immediately at patreon.com/vinylguide. And what you're going to hear in this episode, this feed, is part of that discussion. Mike is talking about the early days, the SST stories, founding New Alliance Records, Mike's time with the Stooges, what he learned from Iggy Pop, and heaps more. There are some great stories on this one. Watt also talks about his recent LP Fitted, which is with a couple of the guys from the band Wire. So if you haven't heard the Fitted First Fits LP yet, do it. Grab a copy now. It's great. This interview that you're listening to right now is part of the conversation. For the other part, another 30 minutes or so, that's up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide, and it is for patrons of our show. Now, you can join anytime, patreon.com/vinylguide. It's only a couple of bucks per month. It helps keep our show going, and it gives you immediate access to extra material, extended interviews, early episode access, and lots more. Go up there now, patreon.com/vinylguide, and enjoy the full extended interview with Mike Watt and lots more. And finally, if you like this conversation with Mike Watt, we have a ton of other episodes you may enjoy, including episode 210 featuring Jazz Coleman of Killing Joke. And man, there's a guy who can really tell a story too. What a past, what an artist. Jazz Coleman of Killing Joke, episode 210 of The Vinyl Guide. The late, great Andy Gill of Gang of Four and so much more joined us for episode 155 of The Vinyl Guide. Chuck Dukowski of Black Flag and SST Records was on episode 145 of The Vinyl Guide. episode 138, featuring Radio Birdman founder Dr. Dennis Tech, episode 138 of The Vinyl Guide, James Williamson of Iggy and the Stooges talking about the recording of Raw Power, episode 127 of The Vinyl Guide, and so many more episodes. Go to thevinylguide.com anytime to listen, or you could check out our mobile apps. Find us on Apple Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And with that, let's take a journey over to San Pedro, California, and talk with one of its greatest exports, Mr. Mike Watt. Am I talking to San Pedro, California?
Well, there's like 75,000 people living here. I think 17 hours behind you?
Something like that. We go vacillate between 17 hours and 19 hours. And we just, when the Northern Hemisphere does daylight savings, we do daylight wasting. So we kind of go in the opposite directions. Yeah.
Texan accent.
Well, I actually grew up in the Bay Area. I grew up San Jose, Santa Cruz. But year 2000, I started dating an Australian woman, and the story writes itself.
I played, there's a Cal State school in San Jose, and I got to share a bill with Maceo Parker.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow.
great alto man. Well, Damon Pettibone got me into John Coltrane, you know, and he played me Ascension. First met him, and, you know, my pop was a sailor, right? I grew up Navy housing and shit. So I didn't really know about this, but I thought he was a punk rocker. I didn't know he was dead or anything. I mean, can you imagine coming from Arena Rock and then seeing the Germs and then somebody plays you John Coltrane's Ascension?
That, for an entry point for John Coltrane's work, is fascinating to me.
Yeah. And then, you know, he starts taking me the gigs to see Elvin and McCoy, Mr. Ray Brown, Cecil McBee, Farrell Sanders, all these cats from those days that were still around. And it was a whole perspective on music I never had before. Raymond is so deep about stuff. You know, he taught me a lot, especially after I lost D. Boone. It was real critical to me. Then I started getting interviews of John Coltrane where he's talking, he's speaking for himself. And they're really interesting. And this idea where people in music are kind of involved in finding some kind of truth, I like that.
So when you met D. Boone, you were in your early teens. Were you into music much before that?
Just before. We're 12.
Oh, okay. All right. You were tweens.
Yeah, I guess, or the end of the, or pre-teen, but barely. Yeah. It's between what used to be, because they've changed again, grade school into junior high. Mm-hmm. It's that summer. That's when I meet him. It's 1970 in San Pedro. There's a park. The biggest park in Pedro is called Peck Park. George Park, Peck, the guy who developed the town, jumped out of a tree on his friends. But his friends had bailed. D. Boone had terrible eyesight. And he thought it was his buddy nicknamed Eskimo. He says, "You're not Eskimo." I said, "Nope. But I just moved here. You want to see where I live?" And so I take him across the baseball fields and shit. And on the way, now, I, you know, 12 years old, I'm not really hip, and I don't have any older brothers or shit. So I'm not that hip to stand-up comedians. Later on, I got into Lenny Bruce and shit. But he starts rattling off these fucking bits. And by the time I get him to my pad to play him an 8-track of the Cream or something, you know, he has blown me away. I'm thinking this is the smartest motherfucker in the world. And so he's like, "Okay, tomorrow night I'll take you to my pad." So on the other side of the Park Western, there was a grade school that he went to. And he's there. And they're beat up there from the Second War. And, you know, econo, I guess, the kind of the housing where you pay a percentage of your income. All right. A lot of the Ma's were around, right, and ran the neighborhoods. D. Boone's pop was there, but a lot of them were Ma only. And he plays me this cassette he taped off the TV of this guy named George Carlin. He didn't make up any of that shit. He had bit all those bits. But it was too late. You know, I was just way into this guy. And his ma played guitar when she was a girl, so she had him take lessons from this guy who lived in his Volkswagen Beetle named Roy Mendez Lopez. Well, you guys are going to have a band, and you're going to be the bass. And I didn't even know what a fucking bass was. I knew more about rock and roll than D-Boo. The only rock band D-Boo knew when I met him was Creedence Clearwater Revival. Yeah, so, you know, of course, he's got all six, you know, fuck Mardi Gras. But he's got the six reel record. You know, Tom Quits. And you really want to hear some Stu Cook and Doug Clifford. So, I mean, they're righteous drummers and bass players.
That's the one to leave in the bin. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, in the bin. You know, in England, bins are like trash cans, right? Maybe in Australia, too. Yeah. Well, so, okay, we're going to be in a band. Basically, she don't want us going out of the house. This isn't a career opportunity thing. It's like she don't want us getting out of the pad after school. It's kind of like some econo childcare shit, right, in a way. So here I got the now D Boone, you know, shit, he don't use the album covers, and you know, on the hardwood floor with the grape juice, and you got to put 7 quarters to keep the motherfucker from skipping on the cheap little stereo close and play shit. I can't hear what the fucking bass is doing. Not at all. So I'm looking at the album covers, though, and I noticed the singer's shirts. And, you know, I was way into T-Rex. In fact, the first gig we go to together is T-Rex, right when Slider came out. And anyway, wow, Mark Bolan, he likes a boa. Well, this guy, he likes these, you know, these fucking checkered shirts, you know. Like I said, Navy Houser, I don't know farmers and lumberjacks and shit. I don't know. I thought that was his kind of rock and roll shirt. So I thought, maybe if I wear his shirts, D Boone will still like me, because I cannot figure out what's going on with the fucking bass here. You know, it was all kind of muddy. And like I said, you know, I thought a bass was a guitar with 4 strings. I didn't really know they were bigger until I was 16. Yes. You know, have you been to YouTube.com? There's a documentary called We Jam Econo. Mm-hmm. That was made 2005 on the Minuteman.
Yeah.
And there's some good background shit on there where I talk about some of this. You know, for a long time, I couldn't even hear the records because it made me so sad. But these two kids that were too young to see us wanted to make a documentary to find out about us. So I had to listen to it again, so because they wanted me to talk about the records in chronological order. And I was kind of interested in the music. That's where my third opera comes from.
I watched that documentary, and I think it's great for a primer on the Minutemen. And you seemed at the very end, when you were going through the albums, through the discography, you seemed very sad, very crestfallen at that point. Was that the first time you'd really revisited the Minutemen music in some time?
Yeah. And then the whole idea of you trying to build a career on your buddy getting killed. I mean, that's fucked up. You know, they say people live when you remember them, right? When you say their name. And in a way, it's a weird kind of balancing act.
Well, I see that as kind of like, that's your first chapter, right? I mean, that was your introduction.
No D Boone, there's no music in Watts World. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the Cream and T-Rex 8 tracks, okay. But as far as making it or performing it for people, no fucking way. And also, I got to tell you, it's kind of the movement too, because it would have been just me and D Boone in the bedroom, you know, kind of like building models, you know, mm-hmm. Kind of looks like the real thing. Not really. Yeah. Copying Blue Oyster Cult. And we didn't know one guy in high school or junior high school that wrote their own songs. Tell you how pathetic the 70s, early 70s were. It was fucked up. But here's the problem, Nate. We, a lot of those guys started bands right when, you know, they did. And we had been tainted. We had been copying off records. We weren't part of 1977. I mean, we graduated high school in 1976, was right ready for it. But we had taint, you know, what we felt was taint. So we thought some kind of radical device, some kind of extreme thing, people wouldn't know it was Creedence Obstacle.
Or George Carlin.
Yeah, George Carlin or Geezer Butler, you know, whatever the fuck. I mean, we were so much borrowed things because that's what music used to be. Well, you know, I did 125 months with Stooges. And finally, I was the youngest guy in the band, and I learned about the 60s in a different way. You know, I was only a boy in the 60s, me and D. Boone. So we heard about the free speech and anti-war and civil rights. But we didn't know about stuff like garage bands and little labels and clubs, because we're arena rock. Arena rock is this one period that's kind of strange. It's this kind of weird thing that fucked up rock and roll for a little bit. And then it got righted again with the movement, I think, by going back to Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard in some certain ways, or that stuff that the Ashton Brothers and Ig taught me about, you know, with the 60s garage bands. Greg Shaw put out a bunch of records. God, he'd master right off them, right? They're called Pebbles and Nuggets. Mm-hmm. And then this is before the big takeover and, you know, Nuremberg rally gigs and, you know, but look, any farmer, you know, I've learned about a little bit about farmers. And if you want a good crop, use a lot of manure, you know. So I say, bring it, motherfucker. I mean, that movement would have never happened without that arena rock shit. You know what? It's weird about that thing.
What were some of the first punk records that you remember hearing?
Well, the first thing, punk was actually seeing it. Mm-hmm. And so there was a big disconnect. There wasn't a lot of records. It was just a live thing. I think the Plugs was the first band to have an album. You know, nobody even had an album up there. Some bands had some 45s that came out, but it was actually seeing them. The first gig we saw was the Bags at the Whiskey. You know, this guy was, here's what happened. Basically, we were with our buddy, Mark Weiswasser, trying to learn Tie Your Mother Down, Queen. And it was, before Fort MacArthur closed down, we're in some rented out rec room thing. And we come out, we're all sweaty, and this guy comes walking by. He's wearing a Kotex around his neck, and he's got his hair out like fucking wires. And his name's Jeff Avisovich, but he's now it's the new name is Nicky Beat, and he plays drums in the Weirdos. And he tells us, you know, there's a scene up in Hollywood where people write their own songs. And we were like, yeah. Is that right? Yeah, that's how pathetic shit was. And so we went up, he told us about, you know, these gigs at the Whiskey on Sundays afternoons and $4 for Ben, and went and saw this. Now that was one side of it, seeing these gigs up in Hollywood. Then there was a record store in Long Beach called Zed. That's how they say the letter Z, right? Yep. Of London. And this guy, Mike Zed and his ma, now they had a connect, you know, there was things with hippie records, especially psychedelic stuff called imports, right? They came overseas, and they'd be, you know, Tangerine Dream, Klaus Schulze, and, you know, stuff you don't find in the warehouse so much, the licorice pizza. And they had the connections on all those little labels over there, even though a lot of those England bands like Clash and Jam got famous really fast. There still was the trippy shit like The Fall and, you know, Lemon Kittens, Alternative Television. And so, and Wire and the Pop Group, and bands we never saw. We only knew them by the records. Sometimes Cream Magazine would write about them, but no one would. So we'd have to pick these mother... Now, the 7-inchers were $2. So it wasn't a lot of money. But you were rolling the dice. You'd go by the, you know, the record artwork or by the name. You didn't know what any of this shit sounded like. But a lot of it was pretty fucking good. You know, sometimes you'd get a new wave piece of shit, you know. There was always this problem. I mean, it kept going into the 90s, right? Alternative. Always this jive shit that was always kind of competing. I don't know for what. Like street cred, militant street cred. I don't know what the fuck is skinny tie. You know, at the end of the day, you know, even the cops going having to go to trial, you know, over imagined bullshit. And at the same time, down the road was Green Day and Blink 182, you know. It was really weird in those days. It just really was in some ways. You just didn't care what other people thought or stuff, and you just dug in deep to this parallel universe. And like I said, these records, also Australia had shit really early too, like Saints.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Radio Birdman. We got, yeah. Birdman,
all this shit, which was kind of connected through the Stooges. Actually, Stooges and Cat Beefheart, they were already doing this stuff. They just didn't have a name for it in the 60s. Yeah. Punk was such a bad word in Pedro. It had nothing to do with music. It was a guy who got fucked in jail for cigarettes. I couldn't believe why somebody would call their music this. But when I saw the gigs, I just decided, well, the first thing, I looked at D. Boone. I said, man, we could do this. I wasn't even thinking. It just fell out of my fucking mouth. And I just decided, you know, these people don't give a fuck what you think of them. They're just going to get their thing going. And I met people like the Black Flag guys, you know, DOA up in Canada, the Husker guys, you know, Ian with the Discord in D.C. There was pockets of this stuff all over, the Dicks in Texas. You know, just, well, you know, we don't fit in with that thing that's happening. So we just, you know, side mouse it.
Now, legend has it that Greg Ginn asked you guys, really your first gig as the Minutemen, to make a record.
We're SST002.
Yeah, Paranoid Time, I believe.
Yeah, it's called Paranoid Time. Recorded it and mixed it one night, $300. I paid for it. Greg produced it. It was amazing to us. We tried with a little studio at the Harbor College, and somebody had a music class, and we tried three songs, and it sounded like shit. But that thing kind of sounded like we did. Yeah, we played. He saw us do two gigs, and after the second one, he said, "Will you make a record?" And that's when the drummer quits. Georgie ain't the original Minuteman drummer. We have a welder guy named Frank Tonchi, and after the second gig, he thought punk was too weird of a scene, and like, he didn't want to be part of it. He was in a polka band before that. Believe it or not, that beat sometimes is used in punk. Well, anything's used in punk, you know, especially 70s punk. 70s punk, like, you could play anything. You didn't even need a guitar player, right? The first band who could sell out the Whiskey was the Screamers. They had no guitar. No rules.
Now, there was SST out of the SoCal area. In this environment, you and D. Boone decided to start your own record label, New Alliance, right?
Because of them.
Yeah.
Found out punk was more than just a band. You made a magazine, you put on gigs, you got a label. You just did every fucking thing you could, right? It was weird. It was like a geo, you know, the go. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just like the new rock and roll in a way. It was more like going back to Walt Whitman, you know, and Leaves of Grass. You know, nobody else will put it out. Put it out yourself. Right. 12 Poems to Stop the Civil War? Oh, yeah, good luck.
So the first album on New Alliance was the Cracks in the Sidewalk compilation, I believe.
Well, kind of an album.
Yeah. What was
that? Song 12 45.
Were you thinking that was going to be a one-off, or did you have bigger plans for the label?
We ended up doing 27, 28 records. We thought it'd be good to do compilations because we were coming out of a movement, and so we should celebrate that. Mm-hmm. D. Boone's slogan for the label was, he came up with the name too. We want to put out records nobody else will. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what he said. So I said, okay. You know, I was just caught up in the thing, you know, the idea that you could make your own records. You know, I didn't have that idea with the arena rock upbringing I had. So we never looked at it as more than just getting stuff out there. And try to make it different. See, it seemed like that was the main obligation. If you wanted to be part of this movement, you had to bring something that wasn't fucking cookie cutter and rubber stamp, you know? That anarchy thing wasn't a slogan, just like we jam Kano, you know? Those like philosophies. You know, we were kind of true believers about it. So that's the big thing behind New Alliance.
Did you have to get a crash course in record pressing from Greg or the guys at SST? Or how did you learn how to make the records?
Through those guys.
Yep.
It's like this. What? You got to go to this guy to record it, right, on the tape. Then you got to go to this guy to get it mastered. Then you got to go to this guy to get album jackets made. Then you got to go to this guy to get them, the labels made. Then this guy will press them up. Then you got to take it to a distributor. You know, all this stuff, that's all from Greg. Now, you know, Greg, when he was young, this is way before we ever knew him or anything, but he told me later, it stands for a solid state transmitter. Greg was big into ham radio. So Greg was about talking to people in different towns, kind of an internet thing, right, in a weird way. So he was about, you know, when I think about the movement in SoCal, you know, what would these guys, I think only the Dills had a van. These guys weren't even thinking about fucking, you know, be king of Hollywood, where Greg was like, you got to get things out, you know? And I think it comes from his experience. In fact, when I first was over there working for them, I would solder these toroid transformers for his antenna tuners to tune your ham radio to your antenna. And so I think that sensibility ham community is just like early pewter community. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you help each other with shit. You need code. You need how to build this thing. You know how to get, you know, because there ain't a real industry kind of trip, right? It's all community. And so I think Greg just took ethics like that over and he showed us how to do label. Then D-Boom puts out a fanzine called The Prole. We start putting on gigs in Pedro so we don't have to fucking drive 30 miles to Hollywood on a Tuesday, you know, to have work at the crack of dawn. And we'd have the start gigs at 7:30 p.m. You know, we start taking things in. That was the whole idea. You take things into your own hands.
And
you know?
It sounds like Greg was very generous with his advice and maybe
Absolutely.
Even a bit of mentorship there. So
Absolutely.
He was putting out records. You guys were putting out records, but
Absolutely.
Everyone saw it as the greater good. There wasn't like competition necessarily.
Not at all. Not at all. Not at all. It was just like, you know, we're in the same van going to the gig, but there's two bands in there. And the Minutemen and Black Flag, I think we kind of inspired each other, but no way did we copy each other's styles. And then that even goes for the other trios, Meat Puppets and Husker Du. Three bands working guitar, bass, drums, three different ways. Mm-hmm. It was important to us that doing that.
Oh, they're very unique, very eclectic.
But the exact same tools. Mm-hmm. You know, look, I wanted to tell you this earlier about being original. Because, you know, you know about writing and stuff. You know, you can write a very original novel and not create one word. You can borrow every fucking word and still make a very original novel. And in fact, if you don't do that, you know, like Finnegan's Wake, it's kind of hard to read.
That's kind of how I read Bad Religion lyrics. So,
oh, man, that bad.
With the dictionary. So Minutemen were releasing albums on SST, but not your own label. Why not use New Alliance for Minutemen stuff?
There's a Minutemen Minutemen record right after in fact it came out before Punchline. It's called Joy. It's a 3-song 7-inch EP. Mm-hmm. Then we put out a compilation called Politics at Times. There's some New Alliance Minutemen.
Yeah, but I
but not
large.
The majority. There's also a Thermidor 1 7-inch, and there was one on Bob Mould's label Reflex. But the majority of our stuff was on SST.
Yeah, to me that's very interesting. Why you would choose to do that?
SST was first. Yeah, we didn't do New Alliance until after we learned about SST, and you know it wasn't exactly the same as the Minutemen. You know, the Minutemen was only part of the compilation. All 6 songs was a Minutemen on Cracks in the Sidewalk. There's Black Flag and Saccharine Trash. So what I'm trying to say is nuts and bolts. It was just a means to an end. We put out some Minutemen stuff. We're both using, because in those days, right, that was the hard thing about, I mean, real independent labels was the distribution. So we're both using the same distributors. And a lot of those cats, they had their own labels. You're competing against these guys who are distributing your records with their own labels. That was the weak part of independent labels, was the distribution. That's the one strong thing that the majors had. Mm. One reason why after 11 years, I went and did a deal with Columbia that lasted 14 years.
You're incredibly prolific. Do you have any idea of the number of songs you've written in your life?
Well, you know, I kept my publishing.
All of it? You got everything?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was a smart move. See, autonomy, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I've written a couple. I wrote more than half the Minutemen songs, but they're not the good ones. Honesty isn't always the best, you know. But
can you remember them all? Can you remember them? Like if you?
Hell no! I have to go back if I want to play them again, which I was doing, you know, because it was coming up on 40 years. Some of these songs mm-hmm. I wrote, and it was weird because they seem significant now. How could something you wrote 40 years ago seem to make sense now? Because we fucking parallel
fucked up.
Get into rerun mode, right? And so I did this when X did their 40-year anniversary, and they had me open up a lot of shows. These songs I wrote for D. Boone and Georgie 40 years ago, I started playing, and I had to relearn them all. Mm-hmm. Now, luckily, they're little and short, so.
Did Double Nickels on the Dime start as a double album, or did the writing process just get out of hand?
No. We got an album done in November 83. Didn't even have a title for it. But then, like, the next week, first week of December or something, Husker comes to town, Minneapolis, to come to record with Spider in Hermosa Beach at Media Access, Media Arts. And they do a double album. They do this album called Zen Arcade. And we're like, fuck, man. Why don't we do a double album? So we write all these songs. And in March of 84, we do another batch of tunes. So if it wasn't for Husker Du doing Zen Arcade, there would have been no Double Nickels on the Dime, which is probably the best record I played on. Cost $1,100. Ethan James mixed it one night, 48 songs. They're little ones. 48. If you don't count the car sounds and shit like that.
Now, some of those records are very collectible right now. And when you hear of some of those records like Paranoid Time or even early copies of Double Nickels going for $200 and $300 and $400, what's your reaction to that?
Well, you know, it's like old basses. Mm-hmm. The dude's playing it okay, but don't be a hoarder. Right. You know, I mean, no, humans are about this fetish stuff. Look at the art world. Jesus. I see my buddy Raymond Pettibone. Oh, yeah. Some of it's not even about, you know, it's like investments or something. Maybe they're counting on it being twice as much next year. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I paid $185 for this John Coltrane reference book, but it was brand new. But that was a lot of money for a book. I've never spent that much money on something like that for myself, for something like that. So for a record, wow. I remember paying $5. I had an A&M Anarchy in the UK way back then. I found it for $5. But I don't know about that. That's interesting. But I think it's more of the value's almost in the object itself. Mm-hmm. The guy listens to it a lot. That makes a lot of sense. If it's some kind of part of an investment portfolio, that's kind of shallow. Yeah. But, you know, that's reality. Look at the guitar and bass world. You know, Mr. Fender, right? Leo Fender, 1951. You know what a 51 P bass goes for?
Oh, geez. Yeah.
Right? And what about old-timey cars? Go to YouTube.com and get Jay Leno. Oh, my God. You know what I mean? And, you know, I had six Volkswagen, one at a time, but I never paid more than $300 for any of them. Think Jay Leno's Volkswagen goes for
$300? So how do you listen to music these days? Do you still spin records or have you converted largely to digital?
I got this thing called an iPod. They don't make them anymore. Well, they want you to be on the cloud. You know what the cloud is, somebody else's pewter. But look. Are you aware I got a radio show?
I do.
I'm listening to stuff there because I got to play it, right? There's usually 40 minutes of talking and 140 minutes of music. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't play anything Mersh. When I was first doing the show, I played the stuff from my collection. Well, I ran out of that quick. So people give me stuff at shows and send me stuff. And I don't play any Mersh stuff, but that's where I learn, find out about a lot of stuff. And there's a lot of, you know, because the technology, people are creating all over the place. Yeah, the bedroom, really easy. Much different than the old days. Mm-hmm. Also, collaboration is a lot easier.
Who are some of the more current bands that you're enjoying these days?
There's a band in England. I mean, I think the guy hits the space bar, but I still like him. Slayford Mods. You never heard these guys, Slayford Mods?
Oh, Slayford Mods. Yeah, actually, they just played down here right before the lockdown.
Okay.
Slayford Mods.
They're kind of new, right? I like them. Yeah, this guy, he's singing. And just the music all together. Like I said, the delivery is the guy hitting a space bar. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's stuff coming out of speakers. And the guy, you know, making a presentation out of it. And I don't know. There's something about it. See, this is one thing I learned about the movement. You don't get caught up in the technical stuff. It's something else that reaches you. Some kind of a humanity or persona, you know, which I could consider maybe a healthy form of humanity. you know, fucking boot on your throat. I like what they're doing these days. But there's a lot of good stuff. You know, the pop group got back together, and they've been recording again. There's a lot of collaborations. You got people playing together because of the internet, trading files. You didn't have a lot of that. It was very hard to do that stuff in the older days. So you got a lot of that going on. So you got cross-pollination.
Let's talk about Fitted, because was that the way that
right
project
there. Was? It's Fitted, right? The two guys from Wire.
Okay. Were you guys in the same room together, or was that trading files back and forth?
Yeah. Well, what happened was the Wire guys have some kind of festival that they put on all the time called Drill. Mm-hmm. And they'll put it in different towns, different lands, different times. And they would come to the Echo Park here, like East Hollywood. And the bass man, Graham, I got to meet him in 87. I mean, you know, they're huge, those first three records on us. But I finally got to meet him. And so acquaintance and Colin, too. But not really, you know, what do you say over there? Mates. But, you know, I look at them from afar, you know. They're really inspiring to us. But anyway, Graham writes me this email saying, will you come be part of this Drill Festival? And me and the new guy, right, they got a guy who's been playing with them like 15 years, Matt, because, Bruce is older gentleman now. And so me and Matt will play with you, and you just find a drummer. So I got Bob Lee from the Black Gang, the band I toured the first opera, played in the engine room with. And the day of the gig, we have a practice. And Jackie from Can just passed away. And it was sad on me. So I asked Bob Lee, hey, just get some things going like Jackie and stuff. And I'll get a groove going, you know, because Graham's going to play bass too, but he's got like 75 pedals.
Right.
Yeah. And then Matt will play his guitar and we'll let the freak flag fly. So the gig goes on. Well, it turns out Graham hardly got to play because the pedal board wasn't hooked up right. We loved the gig so much that I asked, now what I've done with my stuff I've gotten from, you know, playing gigs and stuff is built a studio with my second man, organ man, Pete Mazich here in San Pedro. It's called Casa Hanzo. So I don't have to give a guy $1,500 a day up in Hollywood and drive 2 hours each way. I can do everything. Yeah. So I can record any fucking time, 32 track Pro Tools HD. It's really happening. D Boone, man, he would have loved this idea. Talk about, you know, do it yourself in your town with Pedro guys. In fact, both my second men are longshoremen. They work on the docks. Anyway, I go to Bob Lee. Look, come down. I got five licks here, five songs, and you put some drums behind him, like the same idea, Jackie. You know, get that Jackie. In a weird way, it was like German type of funk, you know, just great grooves from that guy. And so we do this, and then we send it to Graham and Matt. Graham now lives in Sweden, and Matt's in England. And Graham got all his parts, and I think Matt's the guy who actually put it together and mixed it. And I was blown away. I was fucking blown away that dudes not even in the same room can do shit like that. All we got to do is the next stage is not trading files. It's 100% live with no latency. When we get to the point where we can play with each other over the internet, that's going to be really bitching.
So do you think there's going to be a second chapter to Fitted?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Bob Lee broke his shoulder, and he had an abscess on his leg, but he's healed from both of those. And he says he's working on some things. I asked him to come up with four drum things, and then I got four, and then I'll make bass to that, and then I'll come up with the four bass things and he'll make drums to that. As soon as, you know, he lives up the valley, so he's about 40 miles from me.
Right.
And we're in the lockdown, quit in quarantino mode. So when that's over, I think with me and Bob Lee, since, you know, why does a dog lick his balls?
Because it can.
Well, the same thing, Bob Lee can actually come down to Pedro. It's a hell ride, but we'll do that in person. But I like this process where we just handed it off. It was really interesting, you know, rhythm section, right? The old, I don't want to say cliche, but the old idea of the bass and the drummer. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, the bass looks like a guitar, but it ain't a fucking guitar. It's a big kick drum and maybe some toms.
Yeah.
None of the notes, unless you're on one of those fucking 12 strings or some bullshit like that, all the notes are down there with the kick and toms. We're in denial. I'll tell you, the Minutemen made one huge mistake. We should never have George Hurley in the back. We should have put him at the front of the stage.
Yeah.
I mean, this is fucking rhythm music. So all my trios since the 2000s have had my drummers up front. It's just being honest. We got to get out of denial about this shit. They're not stupid people. You know, Chico Hamilton couldn't even get songwriting credits. Big hero of George Hurley's. Yeah, in the 60s. Drummers can't write songs. Why?
You can't have a good band without a great drummer.
You know it. You know it. Well, in this genre.
So let me ask you this. When you got the phone call to join up with the Stooges, did you have to modify your playing at all?
Well, I learned a lot from Dave Alexander, mm-hmm. Ronnie, but I did have to learn them. Mm-hmm. I did have to learn them big time. And in fact, I did it while recovering from that sickness because I had tubes in me. 2000 almost died of this infection. Oh. Sip on page.
Right.
It's on the poop page. It's called The Illness. These motherfuckers, they misdiagnosed me and gave me VD antibiotics, and it spread this infection all through me. And I'm not against doctors. The doctor saved me, but these other guys were pill-pushing assholes. But anyway, to get back in shape, I did Stooges. Little Doll, you know. Well, I found out later that bass line comes from Pharoah Sanders, Upper Egypt, Lower Egypt. No, Stooges listen to a lot of dudes. The thing is, it's deceptively simple. It's all about feel. It's not about chord changes and parts. And that is the greatest thing to learn bass from. So in a way, I went back to bass school from learning with D. Boone, learning off those records, learning off just Stooges music. And it was, and then doing the gigs. Mm-hmm. Still to this day. Even with all that crazy-ass Minutemen shit and all my other bands playing wild-ass and stuff, none of it compares to a Stooges gig. Stooges gig would beat me. Well, hey, I'm playing with these guys, you know, older guys, but that shit. Ig runs a working man set, I'll tell you. The only time you stopped was to clear the stage from the invasion. It was incredible. I mean, but they seemed like they were only 2 minutes long. I mean, they're most exhilarating things of my life. 125 months. What a classroom. Best classroom I've ever been.
If you ever want to see someone as happy as a human can get, watch Mike play with the Stooges. I mean, watching you up there on stage, it's just such a joy. You can tell you're having such a good time up there.
But on the other hand, I want to be buried at sea, you know. But I'd have this nightmare where there's just this tombstone, right? And all that's written on it is fucked up a Stooges gig. So I also had a huge, and that's why I mainly watched Ig, because, man, these songs have been, I mean, we wouldn't even have a movement without this band. We've been listening to these songs for like, you know, 20 years pounded into your head, and now you're there part of delivering it. At first I would get lost and it'd be so fucking embarrassing. So I had to just like totally discipline myself and like, you know where you are, what? You know where you are. And a lot of times, you know, you're not just counting parts. You're listening, you know, because Ig's cueing you. Ig's got a he knows everything that's going on, but he's also going off like a wild dude, man. But after the gig, hey, Mike, I'm going to call you on that, you know, second chorus after the bridge.
He's going to find you like James Brown.
Well, he wasn't like that. He'd be laughing and stuff. But he was really, really responsible about what you did for, you know, he's from the true ethics of vaudeville. You work the room. Mm-hmm. You're not up there to take advantage of people's time. You got to earn it. I remember we got off the stage in Donington, this racetrack in England, you know, 40,000 people. So he goes, Mike, you know, I feel like a short order cook. It's like I'm out there taking everybody's, you want fries? You want a shake? What flake? Strawberry? Like he's playing to each dude individually. I mean, you know what? A better, I don't know, sensei, you know, a teacher, and also a guy's shipmate, right? The bow of the fucking boat. Okay, I'll be the keel. Oh, no problem. It was an incredible experience for me. And I could tell you about the phone call. I was with my second band in Tallahassee. It was right after soundcheck. I think it was the second Cow House, this place. Hey, Watt, you know, so I get on the, and it's Ig. And Ig says, hey, Mike, Ronnie says you're the man. And I looked at that fucking receiver, and I could not believe he said that. He said, will you do me a favor and wear a T-shirt instead of a flannel? I said, fuck you. It was John Fogerty's idea anyway. I said, what about Levi and Converse? He says, that's strong. I said, you know, and then he talked about the lighting for a while. Like he had a nightmare where the drummer was in lime green and the bass player's bright orange or some shit. And then he gets to the music and he goes, now, however we end the songs, that's how we're going to end them. Click. You know, and I'm like, fuck, what was that? What does that mean? So 2 weeks later, I leave my guys in Memphis and I fly SoCal, and we do this one prac in Hollywood because the gig's in Coachella, right? Polo field in the desert. Yeah, the idea of a polo field in the desert. Well, they got like 300 golf courses. I mean, the whole thing's insane. But anyway, I'm there. And I remember the first album, most of the songs are fade outs. Of course, we're not going to fade out live. That's what he was talking about. You know, I thought it was some kind of Zen cone.
Right.
You know, Scotty got me into the Dai Ching. And so those guys were really interesting people. Ig with culture, Ronnie with history, Scotty with nature, and Brother Steve with politics. My ears were like the size of elephants, you know, the African kind. And sponges just soaking. Incredible experience for me just to be around them. And, you know, they're older gentlemen, so we're playing – 3 or 4 times a week. There's a lot of days off. So I spent a lot of time with those guys. Really, really significant in my life.
And what were some of the things you took away from it? What were some of the strong learning points of working with the Stooges?
Yeah, a lot. One of them is work. In fact, one time Ig said to me, there's two good things about you, Mike. You're not afraid of work and you got respect. And I was very kind of him. But I just thought, they deserve the best I had. And, you know, D. Boone, in some ways, that ethic D. Boone had, man, D. Boone never played a gig halfway. You know, so that was an interesting coincidence. A lot of those guys, the Huskers, Hank, Black Flag, those guys, there was a lot of guys in the movement that really did that. Maybe because the Stooges was so critical and inspiring a lot. You could tell when Ig did a gig, he wasn't on, you know, even with Drogas in the bad old days, it wasn't player piano feeding in a piece of paper with holes, dots punched in it. Yeah. I mean, this shit, you're in the moment, you're now, you owe the people. They worked all week. You know, earn it. And also be in the now. Don't drift off. Don't be selfish. Don't get caught up in your own world. It's called a band for a reason. Usually after the second or third tune, it was before 69 usually. Ig would say, we're the fucking Stooges. He never said Iggy and the Stooges. Even when he introduced the band, he'd always introduce himself last and I'm fucking Iggy or something. But he never, you know, he was all about the band. Because you know what? My guess, okay, I'm no expert on the shit, but he's a drummer man.
Oh, that's right. That's where how he started out. Yeah.
Ig comes from Iguanas. Pop comes from, in fact, the first album is Iggy Stooge. He ain't even Pop yet. But Pop was a guy the Ashton brothers told me that lived in Ann Arbor. He hit his head. He got drunk and ran his head into a wall and hit it so hard all his eyebrows fell out. So don't do that. So for this gig, Ig thought, you know, I'm going to shave my eyebrows off and I'm going to put glitter. Well, the reason you got eyebrows is keep shit from going into your eyes. So, yeah, it's a total nightmare. But that's where they start calling him Pop from Joe Pop, a real-life guy. See, when you work bass for the Stooges, this is what you get to learn stuff like this. You know? It's just beautiful stuff. But I think him being a drummer man and knowing what a band is about, it's not some guy just fucking, you know what I mean? It's coming together with your dudes. And so I think that was a core value for him. In fact, when you know, a lot of times they had debriefings and talking and stuff, and you're foot from them and shit, you know. And where's the bass? The drummer, Scotty, would crack him up. You know, those guys, they didn't play together for 29 years. So yeah. It was coming together again. They really enjoyed coming back together again. But it used to buzz Scotty up. He'd start going, yeah, and the singer. I mean, it don't even use names. You know, the singer, the bass, the drum. And these guys grew up with and shit. But he's thinking in band mode. He's thinking, man, I mean, he had all kinds of stuff, like vaudeville things to tell you. Like, he thought, when you do a song at a gig, it should be like a sandwich. That means you got two good pieces of bread. You have a good beginning and a good end. I said, Mike, you can have a turd in the middle there, but man, it's going to be okay. I mean, you know what I mean? This is off, and it's not theory, right? This is stuff he's been using at shows, at gigs. And it's not like know-it-all shit. Every gig's a challenge. We get there 2 hours early. And we'd split it into two rooms, and he'd have one with a mirror in his mic stand. And that dude would go over the entire set in front of the mirror. And we'd be in the other room. Now, this is the Ashton Brother version one. Smoke, you know, hot box of fucking card. I can't believe this. Smoking cigarettes. Now, you know, no drogas, no liquor, nothing until after, you know, maybe some drinking after the gig. But it was nothing like the old Stooges. It was very, very disciplined. Very disciplined. Because you know what? They'd already been through that shit. And I think they were so happy to have a second chance that they never took those gigs for granted. And then when James Williamson, you know, he didn't play, not only didn't talk, he didn't play guitar, right? He worked for Mr. Sony. So me and Scotty would go into his tail room and do the whole fucking set before the gig. Scotty would have a little pad on his knee and play the drum, and I'd have a little pig nose amp. I mean, I know lots of, you know, young people don't do shit like that. These guys were really dedicated to the gigs. Mm. And I kind of came from that culture with Minutemen and Flag and Hooskers. But, I mean, it was really driven home with these guys. And we're doing these, you know, these were huge gigs, right? Festivals and stuff. But they never took them for granted. And so I learned that. And you're only as good as your last gig. And do you really want to go out halfway? Swing for the fence. But keep it together. Play with your band. Be there with your band. Be in the moment. Lots of eye contact. Actually, I learned the eye contact thing. I helped a couple other people before the Stooges. Not many. I heard in 1995, I helped. No, 96. Porno for Pyros. In fact, that's the first time I got to play in Australia. Hmm. In fact, I was afraid.
Afraid of what?
Because my pop had been there in the 60s because of the Vietnam. They couldn't even let the black sailors off the boat because it was bad news. It wasn't like that when I got there, but I didn't know. You know, I was on 20-year-old news, 30-year-old news, so I had no idea. I heard that they were the women weren't treated well, Sheilas or whatever the fuck. And that was all. That was a past thing. That was from my pop's, you know, 60s. And you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was a different time. Hey, it was a different time here too. Believe me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I'm not trying to lay it all in Australia, but that was the first time I was helping Porno for Pyros. And that's an interesting boss there, Perry. Oh, my God. Great guy. And playing with Perkins. Love that man. And Peter, the guitar man. And they, when they play, their eyes are totally on you. They went and took a trip to Bali. And I guess there's a tradition of the ladies dancing there where they use their eyeballs. And, you know, Perry got into it. So, like, the rhythm is in the way they're poking out their eyeballs. And but I was way into this because I got to say, in Minuteman, I was the only guy looking around because I was scared shitless. Georgie, you know, whipping his unit around and D-Boone dancing all over. Those guys, very confident. Not conceited, but Watt was always looking at them like, help me, Mr. Wizard. Yeah. So, with the porno guys, and then after them, I helped Jay Maskus in the Fog, and that's the second time I come to Australia. So both my times coming to where you live is because I help other guys. But me being a side man, side mouse guy, that's kind of not a big thing. But it ended up being huge in my life, these three things, especially the Stooges one. Then later on, I got to do Tav Falco for a tour, and then last summer, I got to do Flipper. So being a side guy is kind of interesting. It really is. Especially if you're going to ask guys to take direction, like for my operas, maybe I should learn how to take direction, right?
Well, sure. It sounds like you like being part of a crew. And you've got a strong work ethic, and you're someone that people can count on, and you work hard, but you're also band first thinking. So it seems like it suits you well.
Yeah, I'm very lucky that way.
Yeah,
I think you have to watch out if you do too much sideman.
Mm-hmm.
You should, I call it sideman-itis. You get really resentful, and you start punching the clock. I've seen this happen to musicians. They start punching the clock and hating music.
Yeah, but that, I imagine that would point to more of a personal thing rather than the role. I mean,
well,
jealousy.
Hopefully the person gets to, you know, be the shot caller on his roles, right?
Yeah.
Well, look, what I'm saying is,
I think you got to be comfortable knowing that most of the people are looking at someone else.
I think life too is a lot about taking turns. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Sometimes you're the shot caller. Sometimes you're taking direction. Even a guy who works at a factory at home, right? He's kind of a different role than he might be at the shop, you know, with his wife, you know, with his kids. Maybe he didn't even write the shit, but whoever claims to be that guy, he said life's a stage, right? We're all playing a role. I think that there's a certain truth to that. And I think it's kind of healthy. It's sort of like the natural metaphor I could use is breathing. You got to inhale, you got to exhale. The problem is the system, the value system, right? You're not winning unless you're the boss. But I got news. If you're the boss, you're not going to learn everything. Mm-hmm. You're going to be missing out on a lot of shit, even though you get your way. So I don't know if that's really the best place to be all the time.
Mike Watt, thank you so much for coming on the show. Question, can I call you Watt? Everyone calls you Watt. It just seems...
Yeah, I can say Watt.
Watt.
I'll tell you.
Yeah.
It's a weird accident because we got an English word that's spelled close, but there's an H. So the way I answered the phone, my pop told me because of the Navy, right? Mm-hmm. You always want to let the dude know who it is. So I answer the phone with my name, but they think I'm asking who it is.
What?
There's a Sam Beckett book named Watt too.
All right. Watt, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing those stories, and really appreciate you taking the time and to really get into it and share with us some of that wisdom. I know I've learned a lot, and I'm sure the listeners have as well. Again, I want to make sure everyone knows about the Watt from Pedro show. You can go to...
No, we say Pedro.
Pedro?
We don't say Fry Joel's and, you know, jalapenos and tortillas, but we do fuck up the name, and the beach is called Cabrillo, but that's it. And even the Latin guys do it, okay? So it's what do you call that, colloquialism? Yeah. But I want to thank you for not asking me the same-o.
Yeah? Oh.
Yeah. Good.
Look, there's a lot of your life that's very interesting, and I gravitated toward the parts that I think the listeners would like to hear, and I'm glad you were enjoying sharing it as well. I'm going to put some links in this episode page for the listeners to listen to the Watt from Pedro show. Also, everyone go to hootpage.com. Let's keep an eye on Watt and see. Hopefully he's going to be touring soon, but there's lots of links and lots of information up there. And again, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're very, very welcome. You're very kind.
There you go, Mr. Mike Watt, ladies and gentlemen, here on The Vinyl Guide, talking all about records, SST, making music, and more. Of course, you can get the other part of this conversation up on our Patreon page, patreon.com/vinylguide. By supporting our show for a couple of bucks a month, you get access to all sorts of extended interviews, secret episodes, early access to episodes, and more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. You can also listen to Mike's own radio show, The Watt from Pedro Show, TWFPS.com. It's extremely entertaining, and I learn a lot about music every time I listen. So that's a Watt from Pedro show. Again, thank you so much, Mike, for coming on The Vinyl Guide.
And that is it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Again, we've got 220-something other episodes available out there. Of course, you can follow us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. We appreciate when you share these podcasts and when you support our supporters. Of course, AudiophileUSA.com, The Groove Washer, SeemsEasy.com, Record Jacket Repair Strips. All those guys run great businesses that support the vinyl record community. And we really need to support the vinyl record community these days with everything going on. So again, thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.